What else are you working on?
Well, we're after a list of creep employees.
Where is it?
It's classified.
Well, how are you going to get it?
We haven't had any luck yet.
Get some. Anything else?
Welcome to the Sound the Football podcast. I'm Graham Sibley, and as usual, I'm joined by Jan Dalton.
Hello.
And in his garage, Terry DeFellin.
Hello.
We're in a new studio this week. We're in Terry's garage.
Yeah, it's my garage, which I've very cunningly turned into a studio.
Yeah, and it is actually a garage, isn't it?
Like, it is a garage.
It's not actually sort of railway arch that you've decided to call like the garage.
True. Yeah, it's not some kind of hip venue.
No.
Yeah. There won't be poetry after this.
Oh, really?
No, man,
I brought my bongos as well.
Oh, well, if you insist. Yeah, you see, we can totally do it.
Yeah, of course. This week, we are going to be discussing journalism.
In football.
Really, we're going to be covering a lot of bases here. It's going to be a very, very broad subject, this, because there's a couple of things that have come out this week. What led me to this discussion is Gary Neville's outburst on Twitter. I say it was an outburst, because that's the sort of language that someone who works for a tabloid would immediately think that someone who said something on Twitter against something was basically making an ad. He was slamming. He was blasting. He was.
It was a broadside.
Yeah, it was broadside was it against.
All, was it all written in caps, or were there some angry emojis in there, or how do we know it was? He was.
I think there was an exclamation mark at the end of it.
Ooh. Did he take to Twitter, or did he just simply update his status?
No, he took to Twitter.
Gary Neville has taken to Twitter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, basically, what he did was, it was immediately after the draw between Man United and West Ham yesterday, and he basically said, this is probably down to the Europa League. Well, what he said was, has there ever been a team that has done well in the Europa League and done well in their domestic league? Is it possible?
Right.
And that's all it really was. That was what the twists were. And it came out immediately after the game. He was probably a bit annoyed that Man United had failed to win at home again for the fourth game in a row. And then that got turned into a Daily Mirror article on their website about the fact that Gary Neville defends Mourinho after another poor home performance for Man United.
Right.
They took that from that.
Just that one tweet. That's what it was. That's what it was.
That's a lot of reading between the lines, isn't it?
It's a little bit of a stretch. I don't guarantee it is a bit of a stretch.
Really,
yeah, but then again, it does provide you with an online article with Man United, Mourinho, Gary Neville, Twitter, all those nice keywords all together, and that you can put up there, and someone's very happy. And now, the guy who wrote this, probably a very young journalist who's working in the newsroom on his own on a Sunday. You need a story quick, bang, there you go, there's another one. And it just goes on to the pile with all the others. But, of course, this one is revolving largely around Gary Neville, about something he said. And, of course, it gets back to him, and he has an opinion on this. And said, well, look, actually, no, this isn't right. This isn't what I was doing here. This is me having an opinion on the Europa League and saying, well, you know, maybe it is a bit of a stretch for clubs to compete in both competitions. Man United have competed in the Champions League and the league, so I wonder if it's a bit of a stretch there to say that the Europa League should be any more intense than that. Yeah. But that's by the by, and what he was going on about was say, look, this isn't me trying to defend Mourinho, this is just me making a statement about something. Mm. But then he turned it around and said, journalism is shit. And basically, he used a blanket term.
Journalism.
Yes.
Not that journalist.
Not that paper, but journalism.
All of them.
Okay. Yeah, so it's basically something. It's probably something that's been building in for a long time. But then again, he wouldn't be the first person to look at Twitter or to read something and think, well, they're all like this, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we must have said it ourselves down the years.
I'm pretty sure we have. I'm pretty sure we have. But after that, of course, he got into trouble again with a lot of journalists who say, well, hang about. I'm a professional. And they all got a bit blustery about this. Mm. They took to Twitter, and slammed him basically.
Launched the broadside. Yeah. Salvo.
Yeah.
Slammed him.
And of course, he got into a big discussion with people who were for or again his ideas.
What type of language was going back and forth?
They were basically tirades. Really,
yeah. Just a lot of anger.
Yeah. A lot of blasted broadsides, basically. Mm. Like
it was a good day to be off Twitter. Then,
yeah.
It's, don't want to get caught in the crossfire.
Every day is a good day to be off Twitter.
I'm sorry, I missed it. Well, I probably aren't sorry that I missed it, but yeah.
This is sort of coming a bit after Gary Lineker. Recently has been having lots and lots of time on Twitter trying to goad newspapers, especially The Mail and The Sun. I don't know if you've read anywhere, but he's currently in talks with Walkers to try and get them to pull their advertising out of The Sun at the moment.
Mm.
And the sort of hashtag stop funding hate.
Stop funding hate. Yeah. More than the hashtag, that's a bona fide campaign who are taking credit for convincing Lego to end their commercial arrangement with the Daily Mail on the basis of all that stuff that the Daily Mail say, and that Lego purport to be a very, very cool organisation, very, very inclusive, and obviously very influential to young minds. So it's an interesting and possibly quite important campaign.
Mm.
Now, this is what it's going to bring me to now, because both Gary Neville and Gary Lineker now draw their income from commercial media. So do they have a point, or are they just playing the game as much as everyone else is?
I think they're playing a game.
Yeah.
I think they're playing a game, but I don't think that they are. They know that they're playing a game, necessarily. I think that they probably deep down understand that this kind of discourse works quite nicely on social media, and that people get behind it, and that it's actually quite good for business.
Mm.
To suggest that they're playing a game is also to imply that they're being insincere in their feelings, which I don't think is the case at all. I'm sure they're being very sincere in their feelings. But I think they must realise that this is all grist to the mill, and it's all fun and games. I think that when Gary Neville says journalism is shit, I think he just means some journalism is shit.
Yes.
And you know, in fairness, you know, that when you have an industry that's so desperate for content that it encourages probably its interns or its lowest paid staff on a Sunday afternoon to sit there trawling through Twitter looking for stories so that they can bash together 350 words, a couple of images and sling it up onto the site, then, I mean, it's not a good state to be in. It doesn't speak well to the quality of journalism. Mm. But that is not to ignore or belittle the very high quality journalism that does go on around us. Mm. Although, you know, it is becoming difficult to find it amongst a lot of the rubbish.
Mm.
Or clickbait, I suppose, is the...
I think there's a distinction to be drawn between what Gary Neville has been saying and what Gary Lineker has been saying. One is just a view on journalists that write about sport, and the other is a view on journalists that write about actual social issues that really, really matter. Mm. And some of the things that Gary Lineker got into trouble about was to do with immigration and the clearing of the jungle camp in Calais and things like that. So I think... his is a more worthy cause, or a nobler cause, if you like.
He's had his integrity called into question by serial liar Kelvin McKenzie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's terrible. I mean, but just on that, I don't want to go too political because I always tend to do that. So
no, apologies. Please do.
But you know, he is going to occupy a space in the news. He's always going to, because of who he is and who he was and who his girlfriend is and things like that. I think back in the day, John Lennon said, "I'm always going to occupy this space in the media. So why not just get my face, get the word peace next to that when I'm in there?" You know, it's an advertising campaign for what I want, what I believe in. And while I mean, there's a difference between what we're talking about and that statement, but Gary Lineker is a very, very, very popular guy. He's all across the news, as I've said, because of his private life and because he's on the telly quite a lot as well. And the fact that he's using that space that he occupies within the media to push something that he believes in passionately and is against the view of a lot of people and the media, I think it's a very brave thing to do, and I think he absolutely should be applauded for it.
How difficult is it to be a journalist these days? Is it harder now than it has been before?
In, say, post-war times, yes. This is the hardest it's ever been. the requirement for content is inexhaustible and the value of the content keeps declining. One is not unrelated to the other.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult to have the time to do full investigative pieces of journalism, well thought out, well considered, well argued, when you have deadlines. It's always been difficult to do that when you've got deadlines, but when those deadlines are really by the hour rather than by the day, it's extremely difficult for journalists to put in decent bits of work. And also there's the extraordinary demand for a type of news. People want to know stuff. They want to know stuff about Manchester United. They want to know stuff about Liverpool. They want to know transfer gossip. They want to know tittle-tattle. And I would imagine that that's quite difficult then for serious journalists to then do serious stuff and seriously examine football when really they're under a large amount of pressure to do popular articles that may not necessarily be worthy or valuable or in the public interest. But I suppose to an extent that is football. But there are some real public interest stories involving football that obviously haven't been uncovered. And we know this now more than ever, frankly, with the recent, frankly, horrible revelations that have come out and are coming out. And so the landscape is exceptionally difficult for a journalist. And I think while it's fun to criticise them, and it is fun, it's fun and profitable to criticise journalists, but it must be acknowledged that it is not an easy job, and the ones that do it well do it really, really well.
Especially when a lot of newspapers have their own slant on things, and their readers have, have the same views. And one of the first rules of owning a newspaper or any kind of media outlet is that you don't go against what they believe. You don't
give the public what they want.
You're going to reinforce that. So if you want to say that Manchester United are bloated, useless, whatever, they're the referee's favourite and so on and so forth, that's always going to get more clicks or turn more pages.
I would
agree with Terry. If you're a journalist with any credibility or you want to achieve, it must be pretty difficult thinking, well, look, I could actually churn out some decent content here, but I'm being told we need this and this because it gets more clicks.
It's harder to be a journalist. It's hard to become one as well.
We know journalists. We know aspiring journalists.
We do.
People are working hard to become them.
We know journalists who weren't journalists when we knew them and they've become journalists.
Yeah.
People who have presented this very podcast have gone on to become...
Yeah.
I would argue successful journalists in that they are making a living out of writing football, which makes them automatically a successful journalist. Because that is the scale of the task, is to just draw some kind of meagre living off of it. I mean, one guy that we both know, I think at one point he was having to write three different articles of around 300 to 500 words per day for a website and was being paid a pittance for it, an absolute pittance for it. And it's a miracle that he managed to get any kind of quality out of that, but it speaks very highly to his... I won't embarrass him by saying who he is. It speaks very highly to his ability as a writer that he was able to produce that kind of work and the determination that he must have put in to make it work. I mean, it's a very, very difficult profession to break into now because there's so little value in the work now that it's no wonder that some people don't even bother trying.
One of the comments on Gary Neville's tweet was basically quite a blanket one that said, if you want quality journalism, you should have to pay for it. Once you start paying for it, you'll get it.
Right.
Do you agree with that? Or do you think that it's always going to follow the money? It's always going to follow the market. Just because one person is paying for it, it doesn't mean it's going to change. It's still going to be the same old, same old.
I think you're always paying for it in a way, aren't you? Yeah. Do you actually past the paywall with any of News International's publications, or you're going onto The Guardian and you get a fair share of advertising, as you do on other free newspaper sites as well? So I don't think that you get... certainly I haven't seen any evidence that it's better one way or the other. In fact, if anything, if you are not being dictated to by the commercial pressures of advertising and you've got another source of income... You could argue that it would be easier to produce quality content because you're doing it for people who actually want to read it. But I don't know. It leaves a bitter taste in my mouth, that, because obviously I'm leaning towards News International with that statement. it's a very difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
I think that remains to be seen.
Okay, because that's not just a problem for journalism. Every online business has to work out how they can make money.
Mm.
And when you're in a competitive market like journalism, because there might be a room full of people in Macedonia that are putting football stories together, not caring if they're true or not, and then putting it out there, and so you've got to face that. Is the market going to change now? Do we think that we've already seen over the last 10 years how the marketplace has changed for people producing content? We've been producing content for God knows how long. We decide on what we're going to talk about because we don't have to keep advertisers happy. But everyone else out there who has to pay bills with what they do, we don't have to pay bills with what we do here. They've got to keep someone else happy. And they've got, so whatever there is to write about, what they have to write about is, some whacked out speculation about who Man United will be signing in January.
But it's also the easier content to produce as well, because it's speculation, doesn't require much insight or investigation.
A source said.
Exactly, which could mean almost anything.
Yeah.
I think that if you want quality journalism, quality investigative journalism, long form journalism, then you do have to pay for it. I think that the model that we have has been in existence really since the early days of print journalism, ever since they abolished. There used to be a tax on print newspapers in Britain in the early days. I forget what it was called now, but it was lobbied very heavily by the emerging mainstream newspapers to be abolished. And it was seen as being sort of like a hindrance on freedom of speech and freedom of expression, because you had to pay this, or everybody who bought a newspaper had to pay additional tax on it. And when it was finally banned, it was seen as a bit of a triumph. The thing was, is it was used to help subsidise freer, smaller newspapers with somewhat more radical or alternative points of view, but were, as a consequence, unable to reach out to advertisers because advertisers weren't interested in advertising on, shall we say, left-wing newspapers.
Yeah.
And so they, under the guise of protecting freedom of expression, freedom of the press, they in fact did the freedom of the press a massive damage by removing that tax. The model has held up ever since, even now in the digital age. Ultimately, it's advertisers who determine the direction that a newspaper or a news website goes. And the only way that you can really overcome that is if the people themselves, the readers themselves, take the full cost of the print journalism in order for them to make money.
Yeah.
Now, we have produced lots of content, and we've all done it in our spare time after work. And it is of a certain level, and it's good, but it is of a certain level.
Yeah.
There's only so much that we can do. It takes you weeks to be able to do that thing that you did on the World Cup.
Yeah.
If you were a full-time investigative journalist, it might have taken considerably less time, but you had to do it in your spare time. And we just can't produce that kind of quality output every week, so we have these nice chats, and they're fun, and I think they're genuinely valuable. But if you want people to be able to find out some really interesting, insightful stuff for you, you've got to pay them. Someone's got to pay them. They need to do this for a living. They can't just be expected to do it in their spare time. That's rubbish. And if you don't want the advertisers to pay for it because you don't like the way the advertisers work, then you're the one who has to pay for it yourself. And that's the problem. It's getting people to do it and then organising it in such a way as to be able to do it. You have to have a relationship with your readers and say, it's like the Blizzard, for example. The Blizzard continues because its readers determine the course. But they trust the editorial staff to write and commission pieces that they're going to find interesting. And if they deviate from that, then that publication goes out of business. But that is an outlier in that it still manages to succeed, despite the fact that in a landscape that's largely hostile to that kind of journalism and that kind of work.
The Guardian have a similar arrangement as well, with some of their backers put in inordinate amounts of money so that the newspapers and their websites don't have to depend as much on advertising revenue.
They're still doing it now, aren't they? They want people to pay.
Yeah.
Our good friend Ian King has a Patreon account, and in fact friends of ours have set up Patreon accounts to try and get people to pay for his content so that he can produce better content, because it does need to be paid for. Until you change the world, until we smash the state and destroy capitalism, then that's how I think. I can't see any other way of it. Somebody's got to pay for content.
Yeah.
If it's not you, then it's advertisers. And, you know, if you don't like it, then, well, tough shit.
And it doesn't have to be a fixed kind of fee, really. It doesn't have to be like a 50 quid a month or 20 quid a month or whatever it is. I mean, there are a lot of, I'm sure you've come across them yourself, podcasts that give their content away free. I listen to a lot of comedy podcasts that give their stuff away free, but at the beginning there's a little 5-minute slot where they say, look, we want to keep doing this and we want to keep doing the projects, and if you want to, you know, go on our page and chuck in a quid, then that'll be really nice. Thanks very much. Well, and there's a way of doing...
Yeah, there'd be nothing to stop us from doing that apart from the fact that we've, you know,
yeah,
our readers are, you know, our listeners would never go for it. Yeah. I don't blame them.
I wouldn't
pay me to
I'm
do
not
this.
Suggesting we should do that. But if there was a little reminder there, like, you know, we're giving you this away for free.
If you want to
just bung in a quid a month, then that wouldn't be the end of the world. For
the right model hasn't been developed yet, and it may never get developed. Unfortunately,
But I think as well is that. With commercial media is the fact that even if you were paying for it, there'd still be adverts there. I mean, let's face it. I mean, like I pay a lot of money for watching live football.
Mm.
Yeah,
and yet there are still two ad breaks at half time.
You're absolutely right, and in cricket,
yeah,
they're still chucking adverts at the end of every. Yeah.
They don't even
get paid for
this
content.
They're still paying adverts for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is entirely off topic, but in the United States they're up in arms because the new Star Trek series is going to be on a streaming platform, which they're going to have to pay a subscription for, and it's going to carry adverts. I mean, they're all up in arms, and I don't blame them.
No, yeah. I agree. Yeah.
But here's the thing.
Yeah.
If the main source of revenue is coming from your subscribers, from your readers, then the advertisers then have to accommodate you.
Yeah.
So if your stuff is open enough and accessible enough to advertisers that they're happy to advertise, and that's fine. But if they're not, then okay, that's fine. That it can still water down content, but you know, I still think that there is room for that. If you could have a kind of, you know, 70% of it is subscription, and if you say only 30% is on advertising, then that way the advertisers understand that their role is still quite peripheral. And if they like that and they're happy with that, and if the content's good and it's popular, then they'll still want to advertise. It's not completely out of the question. But the balance is way out of whack at the moment, way out of whack. But unfortunately, I think it does mean that people are going to have to reconcile to the fact that they are going to have to start paying for content if they want to have any kind of control over that content. Otherwise... It's not up to them. They are in fact the product.
Yeah.
And they just become part of it.
And listeners, because you don't pay anything for this, you just have to sit here and listen to what we've got to say.
Yeah, and if we want to monetize you, then we will. Yeah. We'll commodify you if we can figure out a way of doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Joke's on us there, isn't it? Christmas is coming, listeners. Christmas is coming, that's all I've got to say.
My glass is empty.
you see something very similar with BBC, not just journalism, but also production, in that you are required to pay, I think, quite a small fee for access to some, I think, very good content. And of course, there are people in the corridors of power that want to see that reversed and for it to be opened up to the free market, which I think it would be a bad thing. So I suppose that does lend itself to the argument that if you want to pay for something, if you want to get something decent, then you should be putting your hand in your pocket. And not very deep, really, for the BBC stuff.
The only big sticking point with the BBC is it's not a subscription, it's a licence. And that the reason why it's able to produce such high-quality content is because it's compulsory. Mm. So it's a compulsory subscription. I happen to think that it's the way ahead. And I think that any argument for people paying for content is going to get blown out of the water if the BBC is forced to give up its license. But you know what the thing is, unless they hold a referendum for it, then I don't think it'll happen. because in my limited experience of working in commercial broadcasting, I think that the tidal wave of the BBC entering into the advertising market would be so much that only a few broadcasters would survive, because the BBC occupies so much audience share, and they would be massively aggressive.
Yeah,
they would say, right, if we're going to do this, we want 5 years countdown, and then we're going to go in there and we're going to...
Yeah.
So that what's
not
more
even
like,
Murdoch wants that.
And I think that is a battle that even Murdoch would shirk at. Mm. What he wants is he wants the phase, just, you know, slicing away at the BBC so it's so small
yeah.
that by the time they finally give up on it, you know, it can't fight. Mm. In many ways, it would be better to try and get them to do that now because then the ensuing war would be fun. We could all get the popcorn and just see what's left of Sky and the Murdoch press when the BBC are finished. Because, I mean, you get, or worse, Murdoch ends up taking over the BBC, in which case we all move.
Yes. Yeah, there is that.
We've broadened this out a little bit too much.
Maybe we should focus it back to football. I mean, actually, there is a very, very serious point that I want to talk about regarding football as well. It's because obviously the big story that has come out over the last couple of weeks is the sex abuse story that has been coming out from a growing number of clubs.
Mm.
It does make me wonder a bit, perhaps something that I perhaps shouldn't feel is, well, if this has been going on for so long and at so many clubs and we've got so many people out there who are meant to have contact within clubs, how has this not come out before?
Mm.
Because this is massive.
Mm.
And how are people finding out this for the first time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the idea of ex-footballer journalists, you know, suggesting that the reason why their work is of more value to non-ex-footballer journalists tends to fall a bit hollow because you think, well, you know, if you worked in that industry and you grew up through that industry, did you not know, you know, anything about this?
Yeah.
Now, these are questions that can't be answered and the truth is that stuff like this is so horrifying that, in fact, people, due to their general good natures, can't believe that they could happen. And so that's why you often find people do turn a blind eye for this to this sort of thing is because they just can't believe that it's happening. They refuse to accept that it's happening, and you have to acknowledge that people's faith in humanity is such that they won't acknowledge that. But it does really emphasize the value of good journalism in the football industry right now, because we could be on the verge of finding out some deeply unpleasant truths about that, and the victims of those abuses are going to need tremendous support from everyone within and without the industry, and part of that will be ensuring that the truth is told, and to that we would look to our journalists and our newspapers and our websites and broadcasters to do that, and to do that insightfully and dispassionately and as fairly and as justly as possible.
I think it's the same as when the revelations, again talking about the BBC, when Savile revelations started to come out and everyone was going, well, how did no one know? I think you are right that there's a lot of people who just can't believe that something horrific could be true. But some of the allegations that were made earlier this week, or rather at the end of last week, were about an individual who apparently it was well known that this was happening, and no one ever said anything.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was a case of people were. Oh, it's a very difficult subject, isn't it? I'm going to steer away from what I was going to say. But suffice to say, I listened to Paul Stewart's interview. I think it was on Talk Sport, which was harrowing, to say the least. Absolutely horrible. And the chap who initially broke it, he was on Newsnight.
Andy Woodward,
yeah. And his was also a very interesting and harrowing account of his time. And I think that a lot of the victims of this didn't come forward because in some cases some of the victims were saying that they felt that because it's such a macho sport, or certainly it has been in the past, they thought that supporters, their colleagues, fellow sportsmen would like gay slurs against them for something which clearly was no fault of their own. There's a number of things at play here that for the reasons it didn't come out, and I think it is the same as every time there is a scandal. Or a revelation of this gravity comes out, there is always the kind of how did we not know, but sometimes it was always staring you in the face.
Indeed. And we're going to find out, I suppose, over the next few weeks just to what extent this happens, depending on how many more people come forward, and I suppose depending on what the nature of any inquiry that the FA might have as well. And so and we'll see whether or not this is really the work of one or a few bad apples, or whether or not this is kind of widespread. But
I think an important aspect of this has to be, though, is where football is now, and especially where coaching for children is now. Because what you don't want is you don't want parents to feel that there is a problem in football now. If this is historic, then that's got to be investigated.
Yes.
But also as well, we have to make sure that football now is spotless and it's all clean. We have to make sure that it's all clean, and that has to be projected as well. We don't want it to be like, it's not just football. This is going to be everywhere, isn't it? It's just football has more participants than any other sport, but the problem will always be there.
Yes. Yes, and I mean it's therefore vital that the FA reassure everybody that these kind of measures have been introduced. I mean, there are laws about doing background checks on coaches and on anybody who works with children.
Yeah,
and those laws apply to football as they have, and they've been in existence for some years now. Mm. Assuming those laws are effective, then we can be relatively confident that these will be historical.
Yeah,
but the fear is that they're not. We have to acknowledge that something like football will always attract these kind of people because it's going to be relatively straightforward for them to find targets for their abuse.
Yeah.
But you know, there is a line to be drawn between the odd person, the odd pervert, the odd deviant coming in, and then a system which is so neglectful that it allows widespread abuse. And this is I think what we're about to find out, and the game of football could be in a few months' time very, very different in character to what it is now, which it doesn't please me at all, unfortunately. But it is important to stress that the main thoughts and concerns must be with the victims first and not the sport. That is immaterial by comparison to the outcome and the welfare of the victims.
Yeah, we don't normally do this, but what I'm going to do, I'm going to put a link up on the site to the NSPCC, who are actually coordinating a lot of the investigations now. So they've got a special hotline going on now for any historic sexual abuse cases. So if you need any more information, go onto there and find out about it from there. But I think I think it's time to draw this podcast to a close.
Okay, then.
The newsletter, of course, is still going out. The second one went out this week, didn't it?
It did.
Well done, Terry.
Yes, it did. And I think it's Jan's turn next.
It is.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, you ready for it then?
I've been formulating some stuff in my tiny little suite already.
Looking forward to this. Good stuff. So, yes, the Weekend Box Set is our weekly newsletter, and you can subscribe via tinyletter.com/soundoffootball, or there's a link on the Sound of Football website.
There is. But I think for now, from me, Graeme Sibley, from Jan Bilton, and from Terry Fillon, it's goodbye.
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 You can contact us through our website, sofpodcast.com, via Twitter, @SoundOfFootball, or on facebook.com/SoundOfFootball.
Well, anyway, cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers to the new studio.
Yes.
Okay, so shall we fight before or after we record the podcast?
It's going to bring in the violence, isn't it? By 15 minutes.
Right! Fight.